For those of you who are new or have not been here before, we have an ongoing process of teaching that goes on Sundays. But for those of you who are new and are really new to the practices of mindfulness, we do have orientations several times a month, and we do have introductory classes of 3 and 6 weeks. And we do have Wednesday nights devoted to the path of mindful living. So there are many opportunities for those of you who are new to the practice of mindfulness and mindful living to learn. What I want to do beginning today, several weeks ago, when I talked, there were several of us who had been to Plum Village, the community in France of Thich Nhat Hanh, and reported on that, about our experience there, etc. And again, for those who are interested, I believe that is on the website. All the talks are recorded. But one of the things that I shared was at the retreat, we're handed out something called the 40 Tenets of Plum Village that comes out of Thich Nhat Hanh's in the last few years, kind of putting down what he thought were the really kind of essential teachings. And people may be a little, who are familiar with Thich Nhat Hanh, I know many people are. We know him as this wonderful Zen teacher who makes the teachings so accessible and so practical and so meaningful to daily life, and are not aware that he's also a profound a master of Buddhism, a great scholar of Buddhism, a great historian of Buddhism, a great master of Buddhist philosophy and psychology, of which he has written and which he teaches on. But usually more within the confines of his community in France and elsewhere. So there are these 40, again, and some of them, or many of them, probably won't have meaning for most of the people here because they deal with matters of Buddhist philosophy and teaching, some quite deep and some a little esoteric. For example, there are ones such as, space is not an unconditioned dharma. It manifests together with time, matter, and consciousness. Is that clear? So, I mean, is that... In the second one is, in the historical dimension, every dharma is a conditioned dharma. In the ultimate dimension, every dharma is an unconditioned dharma. See, they're all clear like that. But anyhow, so there are many of them which really are for those who are really interested in Buddhist philosophy or differences between different schools, because this was really his attempt to synthesize kind of his understanding of Buddhist teachings. But there are a fair number that I think are more accessible, and I wanted to comment on some of those over these coming weeks. If not more, we'll see how far we get. Three of them that kind of popped out. One is number 15, which is the awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness and also helps prevent the creation of wrong actions and the planting of negative seeds that will bring about suffering. So this is the one I want to begin with, but let me just share with you the other two. 27, since the afflictions or kleshas is a Sanskrit word, and awakening, bodhi, are of an organic nature, the practice needs to be constant in order for transformation to continue and for regression not to take place. Samsara, this is the kind of wheel of suffering, is a continuation, and the beautiful and wholesome things need to be continued for as long as possible, while the not beautiful and the unwholesome need to be transformed, and the unwholesome need to be transformed so they do not continue. The compost has to be used to nourish the flowers. And then 35, manas, and manas is a very specific term in Buddhist psychology, to denote kind of the seventh level of consciousness, which is the seed of really self, ego, and affliction. Manas has a tendency to seek for security and long-lasting pleasure. It is ignorant of the law of moderation, the danger of pleasure-seeking, and the goodness of suffering. It does not see the necessity for insight into impermanence, non-self, interbeing, compassion, and communication. So again, I think we can all get a little bit of a handle on those three. So let me begin today with 15, and then we'll have opportunity for questions toward the end. It reads, "The awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness and also helps prevent the creation of wrong actions and the planting of negative seeds that will bring about suffering." Okay, so I'm going to read it again, and you see what you make of it before I comment. The awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness and also helps prevent the creation of wrong actions and the planting of negative seeds that will bring about suffering. Okay. I think this is very profound and meaningful and really speaks to the heart of the human experience. As you know, one of the earliest teachings that the Buddha gave shortly after his great enlightenment, the first teaching he gave, when he began his teaching career that lasted about 49 years in India before he passed, the first teaching he gave was the Four Noble Truths, which are just about suffering. And again, suffering, for those who've been around a while know that it's really not the best kind of translation of the Sanskrit word dukkha, because suffering, I think, as an English word, it makes it seem like something very deep, right? Suffering. But suffering in Buddhism encompasses all those deep kinds of sufferings that human beings experience. But it also encompasses things like dissatisfaction, the mind of dissatisfaction. The mind that is always perceiving life as unsatisfactory. It is the suffering is just the mind that is always changing, going up, going down, happy, unhappy. Right. So suffering in Buddhism, the concept dukkha also means just the experience of feeling alone, of feeling separate, of feeling disconnected from. Right. I mean, I could go on, but please understand, so suffering, dukkha, is a very key word that is, it can be very, talk about very gross kind of sufferings, but also very subtle kind of psychological sufferings. What we might call existential suffering. The suffering, even when things are going well, deep down inside, there is a sense that something's missing. That even though things are going good, when the music stops and we are alone, it doesn't feel good still. Right? Is that clear? So suffering is more than just, you know, the gnashing of teeth and crying and loss and, you know, the big stuff. Now, so I think what's so interesting here, he says, the awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness. Right. Most of us, our relationship to suffering is what? Aversion. We don't like it, do we? So our relationship to suffering is, how can I get out of this as quick as possible? Right? We act out, we you know, we act out with others. We do all this addictive stuff. We do all the compulsive stuff. We deny, we repress, we blame. We do anything but be present to suffering. Right? So this first thing about the awareness of suffering is really where practice begins. It's why the Buddha's first noble truth was this: the truth of suffering. We have to come to terms with our own suffering in this biggest sense that I've just shared with you, as well as the suffering of this world, of our fellow human beings, something that is cataloged daily by the news. The news is all about what? Suffering. Who's killing who? Right? Right. Some latest catastrophe of suffering. Who's mistreating who? Who's calling who names? It's all about the suffering. And so a willingness to become aware of suffering as an object of mindfulness, as an object of concentration, is the first step. We have to stop running from, we have to stop denying, we have to stop being ashamed of, we have to stop acting out, but we have to learn how to be present to our suffering, the suffering of our loved ones, the suffering of the world. We need to stop all this other stuff we do and accept that it is an ever-present reality for all of us. It doesn't mean there isn't much happiness and goodness and all kinds of good things in life, right? But yet, at the same time, this dukkha is always there at some level. Now, the awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness. So happiness is what? The opposite of, we would say, right? It's very hard to suffer and be happy unless you're a sadist or a masochist. But for most of us, the experience of suffering is opposite to being happy. When there is suffering, and when we look into suffering, we see that suffering is not something that exists by itself. Suffering is something that arises from causes. There is something that has caused suffering. Suffering within myself, suffering in relationships, suffering in the world. It's not, we are not the playthings of the gods, nor are we slaves to some kind of a defiled self or sin or consciousness of which we are forever doomed to suffer. This is not Buddhist teaching. Buddhist teaching is causes and conditions, cause and effect. So when we are present to suffering, when we no longer turn away from it, when we are able to be present to it, and we really see it clearly, we then can look into it. And when we look into it, we see that within the suffering are the causes of non-suffering. And non-suffering, we might say, is a state of being happy, a state of well-being, a state of joy. In the same way that we see the causes and conditions that support our own suffering, the suffering of our loved ones, if we look deeply, we see in that same place are the conditions for happiness. Right? As the Zen poem says, in the midst of water, they cry out, "I thirst." Right? Isn't that a dilemma that we all look at the world? When we pick up the paper and see another killing, another act of violence in the world, right? We who perhaps beat to a different drum say, why did they do this? Right? Why is this going on? We do that because we have a sense that what? That people can be good to one another. That people can take care of one another. That people can care about one another. That people can be accepting of one another. That people can be tolerant of one another, right? It is the example of suffering and all the types of suffering which clearly shows us there is another way. And we know that. Right? Even those who kill often say, "I'm killing." We go to war to make peace. Right. So even among the perpetrators, there's a sense that somehow there is happiness possible. Unfortunately, their means to it is the means of perpetuating suffering, which we'll talk about in a minute. So, when we are present, let's say, to our own personal suffering, and we're willing to name it for what it is, be totally present to it as it is, and to look into it to see what the causes are, and we're looking for the causes where? Within ourself. As long as we are looking out and blaming and holding external conditions for our own personal suffering, we're looking in the wrong direction, aren't we? I mean, there are lots of causes and conditions that produce an effect, but the effect is arising in our own minds, in our own heart, in our own thoughts, in our own emotions. Nowhere else. And when we understand that, we understand that with a whole different set of causes and conditions, i.e. those that support happiness and well-being and joy and peacefulness and all that of body, mind, happiness becomes possible. And what has shown us that? What wakes us up to that fact? Suffering. Is there anybody here who likes to suffer? Nobody wants to stand up for suffering. No. I mean, if we had a choice between suffering and happiness, which would we choose? All in favor of suffering, raise their hands. All in favor of happiness, raise their, all right, can you see? It's so simple. But it is, unfortunately, we go along sort of on automatic pilot, half asleep at the wheel of our life, and what wakes us up? Suffering. Suffering is the big one. It wakes us up. That's why Thich Nhat Hanh says we need to be grateful for our suffering. It shows us where our life is off. It shows us where our relationship's off. It shows us where our relationship with ourself is off. Okay. Suffering is a disease of the mind. It is the product of an unhealthy mind. When we get, when we have often physical illnesses or physical problems, we often find out that there are things that we can do in our lifestyle that would prevent this, wouldn't it? Many things. Most kinds of heart problems that people have are often the product of diet, lack of exercise, anger, stress. I mean, there are all kinds of causation that are causing that physical suffering. Immediately, if one is present to that and immediately sees that suffering has causes, that suffering that my heart is going has causes, but also there are causes that will produce a happy heart, a healthy heart. It is, but unfortunately for most people, it is the blockage, it is the heart attack, it's the chest problems that what? That wake them up. Right? That somehow my lifestyle, the food I eat, the activity level, my emotional life has something to do with what's going on in my body. And then we have to ask the question, do I want to have a healthy body? Do I want to have a healthy heart? In the same way, again, suffering. Coming to terms and accepting and acknowledging our suffering, the suffering of our loved ones. We say that all the time. Why do they do this, right? I mean, you know, we're so good at looking at everybody else and we see them in their suffering, we see them in their addictions, we see them in their obsessions, we see them in their angers and their fears and their obsessive despairs and ruminations, and we say what? We're all Buddhists, aren't we? We say what? As we talk to our friends or we say to ourselves, you know, why do they do it? Right? Happiness is possible for them. Does everybody know what I'm talking about? We all do that. Why? Because we're willing to look with some clarity at someone and to see that their suffering is not necessary and that happiness is possible for them. And we do that so easily and so clearly with others. Right? And yet with ourselves, we are often blind. Or we rationalize. Or we tell ourselves, I can't change. This is me. We don't say that to anybody else. We want everybody else to change. Right? But to ourselves, we cut a lot of slack. The awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness. Thich Nhat Hanh often says that everything everything is made up of parts. In suffering, we can find the path to happiness. In the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha teaches what? There is suffering, there's cause of suffering, and there is cessation of suffering. And the fourth is, a path that leads. Again, he begins with suffering because it is that condition of life which wakes us up to what's really going on. The same way impermanence wakes us up. You know, death wakes us up. This is not going to go on forever. Right? All of us here are on a timeline. You know, that had a beginning and has an end. The beginning, you know, we know. We all have a birth certificate. But those of us who are here, we haven't received our death certificate yet, have we? Nobody here has their death certificate. But we'll all get it. But we don't know when, do we? That's a wake-up. That's a wake-up call. To say, wow, what is this, you know, what am I doing with my life? What am I doing with my mind? Where am I every day in my mind? And what am I cultivating in my mind every day, in my relationships? Because not only am I impermanent, but everybody in my life is impermanent. And the impermanence is not as often as significant as death. But it has to do with physical health, mental health. I mean, there's all kinds of changes. Financial health. I mean, there's all kinds of changes you know, kinds of impermanence that flow through this world, our own world and those of everybody else. So to the contemplation of impermanence is also something very profound. But again, it's very much related to suffering, because most people suffer because of impermanence. They suffer because of change. In the face of change, in the face of impermanence, we get angry. Or we get anxious and scared and worried. Or we get sad and despairing. And all that's going on in this life is things are changing. What was yesterday is not today. What if today is not tomorrow? Yesterday we were on top of the world. Today, we're just ordinary people. No one's applauding for us, so we suffer. Yesterday things went our way and we were happy. Today things seem to be going the other way and we're unhappy. People are treating us the way we want, we're happy. People are not treating us the way we want, we're unhappy, we're angry, we're sad. It's endless. So, suffering and looking into the cause of suffering leads us to an awareness of the possibility of happiness, well-being, peace of mind, another way of living. As Thich Nhat Hanh has said, suffering is like garbage. If we just leave the suffering to itself, it just continues to rot and stink. But if we know how to compost, if we know how to work with garbage, it can become the basis for the growth of flowers and vegetables and trees. Feed and nourish. If we do not take care of our suffering, if we do not look deeply into it, and if we don't undertake the work of transformation, it will continue. That is cause and effect. Everything we do, all our thoughts, all our actions, all our emotions, are leaving an imprint in what is called our storehouse consciousness. So that means it's not only when we are in the world acting, but just within our own minds, the way we are thinking, the way we are feeling, the kind of mind states that we are cultivating in the privacy of our own lives is always leading an impression in our depth consciousness, and this is what is propelling our mind. This is why things don't change. We may be reading the right books, we may be coming to the right Dharma talks, we may be doing meditation every day, but basically, at deep down, things don't change. Why not? Because we're still cultivating suffering in our minds, in our hearts, in our interactions. And so those seeds of suffering are still very much alive in us, even though outwardly things may look a little differently. It is only when we take this process seriously of transformation and healing that real change becomes possible. And we have created now the conditions for happiness. And as he says here, the awareness of suffering not only helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness, but also helps prevent the creation of wrong actions, right? So if we are suffering, if we cause suffering to another, if we don't stop and look and see what is the cause, what has caused myself to suffer, what is the cause of this suffering mind state, what is the cause of my acting toward this other person and creating suffering, if we don't stop and look at that, what's going to prevent us from continuing that pattern? So it is very important that when we are contemplating suffering, we see that it's related to actions we are taking in our life, both of the body and the mind, and we see that they are wrong because they are continuing to plant negative seeds. We plant negative seeds within ourselves, and we plant negative seeds in relationships. And all seeds will grow. They will grow. If you wonder where this mind state came from, if you were just blindsided by something the other day, don't be confused. Thoughts, feelings, mental formations, mind states arise because of the seeds are in our mind already. That is why we respond in a certain way. There is no other reason. And if we do not learn how to take care of our seeds, and if we don't, our negative suffering seeds, and if we don't learn how to be very diligent in planting and cultivating positive seeds in the garden of our body, speech, and mind, we will not transform. It is really that simple. Again, though, that is why this first noble truth of the Buddha, suffering. The second noble truth of the Buddha, what is the cause of suffering? Immediately leads to the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. Oh, suffering, it has a cause. If I no longer make those causes and do different causes, I will have what? Happiness. To be a happy human being, at its deepest level, is to be a Buddha. A Buddha is someone who has eradicated all the negative seeds. There are no negative seeds left. They've all been used up. They've all been transformed. A Buddha is a human being just like ourselves, who experiences nirvana. Nirvana is the cessation of suffering. Nirvana is the knowing of things as they really are. When we see clearly, and when we live in accordance with that clarity, with that wisdom, with that intelligence, our suffering will stop. So if we are suffering right now, in our life in any way, it is important that we stop, we acknowledge, we name, we look at, we concentrate on, and then we look deeply into. So we can find within that suffering the seeds of its ending. The seeds of its ending is happiness, is the end of suffering. It is in the suffering. That is why for people who try to undertake a spiritual path as something other than transforming their suffering, don't get anywhere eventually. They just create an alternate universe, but the suffering is still there. The affliction is still there. The fundamental delusions are still there. So it is so important for those of us who follow a spiritual life that we are willing to get our hands dirty. It's not all about smelling the roses. It's about getting our hands dirty in the dirt. It's about turning over the compost. Is that clear? This is very important that we understand this. The path to happiness is about the transformation of our suffering. And we cannot transform our suffering somewhere other than in our suffering. Right? It's like, you know, I mean, people, you know, we love to do the nice stuff. We love to do metta meditation, loving kindness meditation, compassion meditation. We love to visualize and imagine all kinds of wonderful things, right? And we somehow don't think that it has to do with all the people in the world, like especially the ones we don't like. Oh, I'm such a loving person. I cultivate love and light. Except when I run into these kinds of people in those kind of situations. Then I'm full of anger and hate and despair and all that stuff. Right? So if you find in your life that you are suffering in any way, in the ways I talked about, from the gross sufferings of emotional afflictions to the very subtle sufferings of disconnection, aloneness, separation from. Please look at that. See what's causing those kinds of feelings to arise within you. You weren't born with them. Right? Newborn babies are not depressed. They're not anxious. Are they? No. These mind states, these emotional states, are things that have been developed through the course of our individuation, through the course of our becoming a self and identifying it as a self and seeing the world as the other and feeling separate from that world. So we need to see that our suffering is within us, and our suffering is the path to awakening. As it's said in the Buddhist tradition, the lotus grows in the mud. Everybody's heard that, many of you heard that. The lotus grows in the mud. The lotus is something what? Beautiful. Who wouldn't want a lotus? Well, there's no lotus without mud, because the roots of the lotus is in the mud. The source of the beauty of the lotus is the mud. And that is used in Buddhism to show us that it is our suffering, it is our is the mud of our afflictive emotions, in which that is the soil in which all the qualities of compassion and understanding and equanimity and patience will develop. But we have to be willing to see the mud. We have to be willing to work in the mud. We have to be willing to work with our own mud and everybody else's mud. Because as you might have noticed, it's a muddy world. It is not a world in the way people act and treat each other that is all based on enlightened, awakened interest. Altruism. The real caring about everybody else is not the modus operandi of the world, is it? And it's not the modus operandi of the world, not because all politicians are bad. It's only because politicians are just like us. They just have more power, so they can affect it more. But we need to look at in our own lives. Are we really altruistic? And again, real altruism really develops when it's difficult. Right? You know, it's like when I don't want to be altruistic for this person, I don't want to think kindly of this person. I don't want to help this kind of person. I don't want to be accepting of this person. I don't want to, don't get me to talk about the good qualities of that person. I just want to talk about their bad qualities. So the altruistic mind, the mind of love, is something that needs to be developed and cultivated across the spectrum, especially where it's difficult. Many people develop a loving mind and an accepting mind and heart for oneself is often most difficult. Or the people who live closest to them is often most difficult. It's kind of strange. You'd think it should be the opposite. And yet it's true. The awareness of suffering helps us recognize the existing conditions of happiness and also helps prevent the creation of wrong actions and the planting of negative seeds will be about suffering. So in Buddhism, this is one of the key in terms of what's called right energy. Like, what are we doing with our energy? The energy of our mind, the energy of our body. You know, what are we doing with our energy? And what he's, and these are two of them, right? Right? We need to stop cultivating wrong actions of body, speech, and mind, and we have to stop planting negative seeds in our mind. If you are mad at somebody, anybody here ever been mad at somebody? Right? And do you notice that when you're mad at somebody, you ruminate? How many times do you play the scenario, whatever made you angry, over and over in your head? How many times? What? Hundreds. Right? And not only do you just, you know, kind of visualize it, you also get up a good, you know, head of steam around the emotions. Right? So, I mean, we ruminate it within ourselves. We talk to other people about it. You know what I'm saying? Now, what is that doing? Seeds. Imprints in our mind, which has a karma, has a forward energy, which then is conditioning future experiences. Right? If we want to be angry people, or people who respond to certain situations always angrily, this is the way to go about it. All right, so you're doing a good job. Isn't that clear? Constant repetition is training, right? Is that clear? When we're training in anything, the way we develop competency is what? Through repetition. Right? We do it over and over and over again, and over time we get better at it, right? Well, please think about, in your internal mind states, in your words to other people, what are you cultivating? What are we cultivating? Because this is karma. This is our karma. This is cause and effect. This is what's conditioning the next moment. And the next moment. And as long as we continue to cultivate the same kind of negativity and afflictive emotions, it will continue. It's just science. I mean, it's just cause and effect. It's not a sophisticated way of thinking. It's sophisticated because it's so simple and obvious. So we need to stop, right, doing wrong actions of body, speech, and mind. We need to stop cultivating negative seeds. And we need to start what? Cultivating positive seeds. Engaging in actions of body and speech and mind that produce well-being, that produce happiness, that produce love, that produce openness, that produce patience, that produce mindfulness. You know what I'm saying? These are the things we need to be cultivating. So the seeds that are being planted and cultivated within our mind stream begin to grow. They will not grow by themselves. They will not grow just by reading the books. They will not grow just by attending the talks, will they? They grow in the intimacy of our own minds. That is again why in the Buddhist meditative traditions, meditation, mindfulness, concentration, insight are key, because they deal directly with the source of the problem, our minds. That's the technology. Mindfulness turns the light. Switch on. So we can see what's going on in our mind. We can see whether our mind is happy or unhappy, whether our mind is suffering or not suffering. We can look at it and concentrate on it, concentration, so we get very clear about what's going on. It's not like a little glance. We look right at it. We put it center stage. We concentrate on it. And then we look deeply into it. What's causing it? What sustains this suffering pattern in myself? Sometimes that answer is very obvious. Sometimes it takes deep looking. It's under layers. Sometimes the cause is very close. Sometimes the cause may be decades ago. But that is why it is important to have these teachings that tell all of us that in the suffering is happiness. Coming to terms with suffering shows us the path of healing and transformation. That's true for everyone. Because all of our suffering comes from seeds. All of our happiness comes from seeds. And if we become good cultivators of the seeds of our mind, there is no reason that we cannot be happy. And that, you know, we may not make it to full Buddhahood in this lifetime, but everybody in this room has the potential of doing everything I've said today. We just have to begin to take our own healing and transformation seriously and devote as much time and energy to it as we devote to things that don't produce it, that produce the opposite. We have to really see, what we're doing and the way we're thinking and behaving and interacting that is sustaining our afflictions, and make a commitment to cultivate a different set. You know, when Marilyn, when we bow to the Buddha, remember at the end of walking meditation, and what did you say, Marilyn? We bow to the Buddha because why? There it is. Everybody hear that? Because the Buddha is a symbol here, a representation of the capacity of all of us to be awakened. The Buddha was a human being. He was not a god. He was a human being. He had a mother and a father. He had a wife. He had a child. I mean, it doesn't get any more human than that. And what made him a Buddha was that he looked deeply into suffering. He looked deeply into the impermanence, and he looked for the sources of that in his own mind. And the wisdom and the understanding that he developed through the meditative process was a very human understanding. He looked into the same mind that we have. He didn't have a different mind. He had the same mind we had. It was aware, it had consciousness, it had five senses, it had thoughts, it had feelings, it has perceptions, it had ideas. It was just like our mind. But he used the tools of mindfulness, concentration, insight to go deeper than, to look into deeper than, to see causations. And when he saw what the causation was, he immediately was able to see what the solution was. Not just intellectually, but experientially. So it really transformed him. He did it. And we can all do it. We may not be able to do it with the absolute commitment and sincerity and energy of the Buddha. But certainly in terms of, as I say, the afflictive, neurotic components of our minds, our lack of intelligence, and especially with all the kind of either toxic or wasteful or superficial kind of activities that we spend our lives in, you know, much of this can be easily changed. But we have to have this sense that Marilyn talked about, that we have, each of us, the potential to lead an awakened life. An awakened life is a life that we're not asleep. We're not asleep at the wheel of our life. We're not on automatic pilot. We're not just stumbling through life, sometimes happy, sometimes unhappy. Sometimes things are going our way, sometimes they're not going our way. You know what I mean? We kind of stumble through life. But that we can live life with real purpose and meaning and clarity. That potential is there for everybody in this room. We have a couple of minutes. Any questions? I've been doing all the talking. Forgive me. But we're all going to be getting up from here in about 15 minutes, and we'll be going back to our lives. You know, what do you think? Everybody clear about this process to recognize the awareness of suffering and to recognize the existing condition of happiness that lie within us? And that we know how to prevent the creation of wrong actions, and we know how to stop planting the negative seeds that will bring about future suffering. Any questions or comments about that? Anything not clear? Don't be shy. You know, this is not a sermon. I'm not preaching today. This is what's called the Dharma talk. I'm sharing the Dharma. The Dharma is something that helps us wake up. Yes.
Thank you very much. That's clear and effortful. Sort of contrarian,
yeah,
stance.
Fine.
Some say happiness is overrated.
Mm-hmm. So I get the question because there are... So the question is, there are those who say happiness is overrated. So what's your name?
Peter,
what does that mean? I mean, what those contrarians, I don't know if you're one of those or other people. What does that mean, happiness is overrated?
It came to me from something I read or saw as a character in a movie where we all strive for happiness. There's routine, responsibility,
and that. Yeah. So that's good. So Peter's just going on about, yeah. So this is important, Peter. Maybe I can clarify by saying, In the Buddhist tradition, happiness is not the happiness that the contrarian is talking about. Most in our society, you know, people want to be happy, right? And happiness is also talked about, right? And somebody says, well, happiness is overrated. Because they equate happiness with sort of what? Kind of euphoria or... I don't know, getting what you want, or things are going well, or, you know, going to a good movie, or having a good dinner, you know, things that make me happy. People make a happiness list. What's on their happiness list? Going to the beach, happy. Nice weather, happy. Getting a raise at work, happy. What? Enjoying a new Netflix series. Happy. Right? You know, my favorite song comes on the radio. How are we? Happy. You know what I'm saying? So there is lots of happiness in the world, or kinds of happiness. But what the Buddha said about all that, he didn't negate it. He said, the problem with all that happiness, it is dependent on external circumstances. So it's a kind of a superficial happiness, Peter. And it is predicated on the opposite, right? So when things don't go our way, when we have a bad meal, when we're planning to go to the beach, but then it rains, you know what I mean? Then we're what? Unhappy. So not only is worldly happiness dependent on situations, right, to support our happiness, but they're also have within them the potential for suffering when the opposite happens, right? So it is for that reason that the Buddha said worldly happiness is very impermanent and temporary and is very undependable, right? And his search for happiness was for a search that was not based on external situations. How can we develop within ourselves an so-called inner happiness that is coming from the inside and that is always there? It is a state of being. It is a state of mind. It's not like jokey, jokey, happy, happy, giggle, giggle. Right? It's like a deep sense of everything's all right. Everything's good. It's a heart of openness. It's a heart of love. It's a heart of friendship to all beings. It's that kind of happiness, and it's unconditioned. You know, most of us we're happy when we're with our friends, right? But then when we're not with our friends or people with people we don't like, we are what? Unhappy. Again, there's that duality, that polarity. We want to cultivate kind of a heart that is open and loving and friendly to everyone, then it can't be ever taken away from us because it's unconditioned. Right. So I'm glad you asked the question because in the Buddhist teaching there's a lot to be said about so-called worldly happiness, which again is real. I mean, we all know that there are many things in this life that give us happiness, but we know that they're all conditioned, right? When our kids are doing well, how are we? Happy. When they're not doing well, how are we? Unhappy. Right? So it's not a good kind of happiness. Because it can easily turn into its opposite. Right? So many people talk about love. But they talk about a kind of worldly love because we know a worldly love can turn into what if it doesn't get its way? What? Hate. Anybody ever experience that? Yeah, why is that? Because it's a worldly love. It's based on outcome. It's based on how, you know, how it's all set up. As long as it's set up my way. As long as my needs are getting met and the person's acting the way I want, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera, then what? I'm in love. This is wonderful. Until the opposite happens. Then what? I'm in hate. Right? Well, this kind of deep looking means somehow we step back from that and go, wow, is that kind of worldly love really productive of a real peaceful heart? Of a real loving open heart, or is it a conditional love? Conditional love means it's on and off. It's on when situations are right, it's off when situations change. Is that clear? But the kind of the kind of compassion and love and friendship of open-heartedness that is in the tradition is unconditioned. It's like it said, the sun You know, the sun, it shines, right? It shines in everyone, right? It shines in Republicans and Democrats, right? It shines on, Muslim, Islam, fundamentalists. It shines on Christian fundamentalists. It shines on Jewish, Buddhist fundamentalists. The sun just shines. It shares its warmth with everyone. It gives its life-giving powers to everyone. The rain rains on everyone, good people and bad people. So it's a different kind of love, and it's a different kind of happiness, because it's cultivated from the inside. It's cultivated in our minds. Is that clear? So it is not something that can be taken away from us. So good, we should stop. So thank you. So we'll continue over these next weeks with these other tenets, at least the ones that are somewhat understandable.